This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
While you were vacationing last summer, there were groups of middle school students around the country on a quest in the search for the origins of life.
When you work with Earth, it's like you're already exploring the life, except it's more complex. And so when you go beyond to the final frontier, you can have more diverse life.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, our astrobiology series returns with the students of the ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp and learn about their quest to find life on one of the moons of Saturn. Plus, we'll spend an academic minute exploring the winds and the waters of this planet. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Each year, more than 50 universities host the ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp, which brings students together for a scientific experience that will likely stay with them well beyond the 2 weeks of camp. For the fifth year, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute invited 48 middle school students from New York State's Capital District to design spacesuits, build rockets, and learn about astrobiology. Teams of students developed proposals for missions to search for life in the solar system that were then evaluated by scientists. This year, the winners came up with a plan for finding life on Titan, one of the largest moons of Saturn. We'll hear from the students in a moment, but first, the Best of Our Knowledge is science reporter David Gustina spent some time with Cynthia Smith, Assistant Dean of Students and Director of Pipeline Initiatives at RPI, to learn about the program.
We have representatives from 11 counties in this region, and they're young students going into grade 6, 7, and 8.
And they have this interest that you're pushing them forward with. Mm-hmm. And as we've seen in the past when we've done reports on the science camp, This really carries them much further in life.
That's correct. Many of them, almost all of them, have demonstrated a keen interest already in science and technology, and they know what they know coming in. And they're frequently, almost to a person, astonished at how much more they learn in the program.
And you provide them with so much. Why don't you talk about the teacher involvement, and not to mention the RPI professorate that come in and work with the students. What are the support systems that go with this?
Mm-hmm. Well, we hire at Rensselaer a student staff to work with the students. Oh. And the student staff is comprised of 13 Rensselaer students and a junior counselor, a student who's been with us before as a past camper. And these students live in the dorm with the students, and they mentor them not only in the dorm, but in the classrooms. They each follow a team and help the students with the technology or perhaps some insight. They don't lead the students, but they are there to assist in any way that they can. In addition, this year, we hired 8 local teachers to work with all of the students, and they ranged in skills and interests from science and technology to math and history and persuasive writing and
public speaking
as well. And our camp really tries to help the students be prepared to not only be successful in the camp, but to take it to the next level.
Most folks are familiar with RPI and its incredible reputation for excellence. And why don't we remind people before we go any further, who is Bernard Harris?
Bernard Harris is the first African-American to walk in space. He's done 2 missions in space. And after leaving NASA, he went into venture capitalism. And now he works in not only supporting NASA's missions, but also areas of healthcare and education.
And he comes in and talks with the students, doesn't he?
Yes. Dr. Harris joined us again this year. He came in on a Sunday night, met us after the students returned from the American Museum of Natural History, had dinner with us in the dorm. That's our special pizza night in the dorm. And he was just enjoying the kids and having fun and played capture the flag with them.
So he is active.
Very active.
That's wonderful.
It's fun to watch.
How about we continue with this? Because I know there's a day-to-day schedule. Why don't you go through the routine that the students tend to go through?
Okay, so they arrive on a Sunday and get to know one another. And then Monday starts the week. Dr. Whitett and Dr. Delano introduce the program and the team project idea to the students. And then they started right into classes.
This, I think, Cynthia, you might agree, is, how do I put this? absolutely, completely rewarding for all involved. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I think that my experience with the pipeline programs has been the most rewarding of my life. I look forward to this camp in particular every single summer because I love working with middle school kids. I never thought that this would be, you know, something that would really excite me so much. But middle school students come in with no preconceived notions. They are totally open to everything that comes their way, especially the younger ones. The older ones have a little bit more knowledge behind them, and they tend to maybe think a little more critically than some of the younger ones. But however, the rising sixth grade students that we have had with us generally are leaders within their teams and within the camp. They really rise to the challenge of everything that's put to them and are great contributors. The Harris Foundation has been a strong believer in the fact that, you know, working together within these groups is very, very positive because, you know, the fifth graders come eager. The seventh graders come with knowledge, and they actually help to increase the knowledge of the whole.
So now that we've learned a little about the program, let's meet the heart and soul of the project, the students.
My name is Leah Mangulis. I go to the Broadalbin Post Middle School. I'm entering eighth grade, and I was the team leader, the physicist, and I shared the role of mathematician.
How did you become the team leader and become the physicist?
Well, when we were assigning the jobs, no one wanted physicists. So I just took that job. And then a couple people wanted the team leader, and they said that I could have it because I didn't really like my job. And, well, it worked out good. Because, I think all of us on the team could have been team leader because we were all really strong workers.
Well, that's good to hear you say that. That's a very big compliment to Neil and Vincent and some of the other team members, Tatiana and Olivia, who aren't with us today. But why don't we go over to Neil? Neil, you introduce yourself.
My full name is Neil Tarun Devanini. I'm going into sixth grade. I go to Manans Middle School now, and I'm the biologist.
Did you have an interest in being the biologist, or were you assigned that?
Well, everyone voted on what they want. So in the end, pretty much everyone got what they worked with. So I got the biologist.
What were you responsible for?
Well, I was responsible for the chemical components for the atmosphere, the ground, and seeing if it's suitable for the bacteria on Earth or any life, and see if there's tiny particles of water inside or stuff like that.
All right, we're going to go over to Vincent now.
I am Vincent Romero Scott. I am going to 7th grade, and I go to Berlin Middle School. My role there was geologist, and I shared the role of mathematician with Leah.
Well, congratulations to all of you again. Now let's turn to the actual project and what you've done. You chose to, in the quest for life, make the journey to Titan. Leah, how come Titan?
When we all had our groups together, there was the list of places that we were able to explore. In most cases, the team got what they wanted most, and for us, that was Titan.
Is it, Neil, maybe that people want to, when they do these projects, explore something outside of the Earth?
Yeah, I would think so, because it's when you work with Earth, it's you're already exploring the life, except it's more complex. And so when you go beyond to the final frontier, you can have more diverse life.
Sure. And I would imagine, Vincent, that as you're doing some of these field trips that you were on, you went to Thatcher Park, you went down to New York to the Science Museum. I would imagine it was very helpful to go on these various trips to establish what is life.
Yeah, going to museums helped because you could see how the other life back then acted and how it could form. And if it's forming the same way on another planet, it's possible with the right conditions that could happen again.
But why is Titan so interesting for an exploration in the quest for life?
Well, there are certain experiments conducted by Sarah Horsch where she took the atmosphere of Titan and she did some experiments with it, and she got the components for RNA. And RNA is
ribonucleic acid?
Yes.
But one of the essential building blocks, right,
yeah,
along with DNA.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a prime experiment that proved that, hey, we might really have a situation here on Titan in these methane and ethane lakes where we might be seeing formations of life. Okay, so I see in your first frame up here on your poster board, it says Mission Go. You've even worked it down to where you will launch from. How about you, Vincent? Talk about what you had to do. Not only are you doing the science, but you have to calculate everything from where are we going to fly this mission from to are we doing it in a cost-effective way? Talk about that.
Well, we kind of want everything to be perfect. We picked where we wanted to land and nothing was too costly.
Did that involve a constant review of your work?
Yeah, we look back on it to make sure, and sometimes when we look back on it, we wanted to change it so nothing would go wrong and can't be too perfect, but you want to be right there.
What were some of the revisions? Do you remember, Leah?
I don't think there were any major revision, the things we did. When we would collaborate after doing our separate work, we would see like what other people did and how we could improve that.
Yeah, that should probably be made clear, right, Neil? I mean, you had your teams, but you're also all working together.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit more about that. What was it like on a given day at RPI?
We'd wake up in the morning around 6:30. We would have attendance. We would go to breakfast, and then usually we'd have a lot of classes for background. And then at the end of the day, we'd be working with our teams on the request for proposal. And so what happened was, first we had each person get the information that we needed. And then towards the end, we would like analyze it and make it a lot better, paraphrase it and things like that, and make it into our presentation.
What was it like for you living on a college campus for a couple of weeks?
It was pretty good.
Were you homesick?
A little bit.
A little bit. What about you, Leah? What about you, Vincent?
I loved it. I thought it was awesome. Get away from my family for 2 weeks.
Whoa!
I love you, Mom, but you annoy me sometimes.
Oh, boy. Now the honesty is flowing in the room. We see why Leah has these leadership qualities. She's not afraid to speak her mind. And how were the college students that stayed with you? Were they good?
They were really nice. They were very helpful towards the projects.
So you could seek advice from them. You could seek help from them. And they were there for you, yeah?
Yeah.
Still to come, more of our visit with the students of the ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp of Upstate New York. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1171. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our special guests today are the students from last summer's ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp from upstate New York. They're talking about their experiences at the camp with The Best of Our Knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series.
Tell us about how you came to the conclusion of how you were going to actually fly through space and get to Titan. Leah, why not?
We decided that we would launch, I think, mid-December, and after 7 months of journey, I think, we would eventually reach Titan's atmosphere. We planned our flight to make the shortest mission possible,
right,
to save on fuel and energy.
But tell us more. How are you getting there? What is the, forgive me for this word, the contraption that you built to go there?
We sent a rocket?
Yeah, but transcribe it. I see all sorts of descriptions up here. I see a picture of it. I see it's going to slingshot and do all sorts of stuff.
I'm pretty sure we're going to use, I forget what it's called, but go between the planets, and it's kind of like slingshot towards.
The idea is to gain speed as it travels, right, mm-hmm, and use the gravitational pull to help it slingshot and move faster to get to your location.
I think the slingshot method was actually taught in one of our classes. And then we also saw a demonstration of it when we watched Apollo 13.
Yes.
Where they went out of oxygen in space and they slingshot around the moon to back to Earth.
That's correct. But of course, this is an unmanned spaceship that is moving through space and using this gravitational pull. So you were able to figure that out. Did that save on cost?
Yeah.
Explain budgeting for a minute, if you would. Any one of you.
that was kind of like assigned to one person, like budget, but in reality, we all worked on it pretty hard, because it was difficult to decide the prices of everything, because it's not like you can just go online and say, oh, I need some rock laser and nuclear stove and things. Like, you have to, like, estimate costs of things, so it's hard to get, like, an accurate measurement.
Were there any sort of things that were provided to you to help you estimate a cost of some of these materials?
They did help us, like, how much of our budget should be spent on our rover and how much should we spend on getting there.
So how much did it cost?
We had a budget of $100 million.
What?
It's a little. It's a little.
Yeah, that's not a lot.
See?
It's very little.
I'm glad you reacted that way, because Cynthia Smith and I talked a little bit about how you had to do budgeting, and she said, are you kidding? $100 million is not a lot of money for a project like this. So really, you're keeping the costs way down when we're looking at something like space travel.
Ours was still way up. Well, yeah. Even over $100 million. Everything was just expensive.
Yeah. Well, so now you're hurtling through space, slingshotting with the gravity, and now you're going to enter into Titan's orbit, and you're going to land on Titan, one of Saturn's moons. And how's that going to work, Vincent?
Yeah, we were going to stay in its orbit until it was a good time so they didn't have any storms there. It's kind of like there's like a methane water cycle there. It's a methane cycle instead. And also, when it was the right time, we were going to go down, have 15 seconds of free fall, and then have a parachute that'll slow it down.
And what's the parachute made out of?
We'll probably be using a supersonic parachute, like the one used to land Curiosity, because it can withstand the force of an object falling from the edge of space. Since it has a very thick atmosphere, a supersonic parachute can slow it down to a relatively slow speed.
What's a relatively slow speed, Leah?
Well, at first we're going to be traveling like 1,000 miles an hour maybe, and this can slow it down to probably somewhere in the 200s.
Okay, so that's slowing it down quite a bit, and then you had something that we have in our cars now to help you prevent it from braking when it hits the ground, right?
Yeah. Airbag.
Yeah, we decided to deploy airbags.
And are these special airbags?
Yeah.
What's special about them, Neil?
Well, they need to be able to withstand enough pressure, and when they go out, it shouldn't have any harmful chemicals in it.
So what happens when it lands? Because you have a rover that's going to now take over.
Well, basically the rover itself won't be landing. It'll be landing in a capsule. So once the capsule is safely on the ground, it will trigger a door to open and the rover to drive out.
Wow. Okay. So then the rover drives out. And then what's going to happen? Neil, why don't you start?
First, we thought that it should take samples of basically everything that Curiosity took samples of, because Curiosity is like a very thorough mission. So we wanted ours also to be very thorough, because the last mission that made it to Titan, it lost power. So we want ours to be very thorough. And also we have an original idea where we use a vacuum chamber with anaerobic bacteria to test their durability.
Tell everyone what anaerobic bacteria is.
It's a type of bacteria that only needs nitrates and sugars.
Aha.
It's microscopic.
So this was something that wasn't thought of before. Congratulations on that. I don't think I would ever come up with something like that. Well, how did that come to be, Leah?
Well, one day, Cove, he was part of our team, he thought of sending some archae up there because they can survive in very harsh conditions. You don't generally see them. They're found in places like volcanoes, hot springs, and, well, cow stomachs.
Okay.
And we don't want to contaminate that because it is an invasive species. So our idea was to bring a vacuum chamber, put Titan's atmosphere in there.
And with, see how that...
with the anaerobes.
And see how it
And see
interacts.
If it survives and...
how it reacts. We're also going to take samples of the methane lakes because they're like an organic compound. So if we take samples, it's good for information. So we thought of that. And we also wanted to drill through the ice and to see if there's water on the inside.
So how does that work?
Well, we thought of a heat drill. It's really durable, so yeah.
And obviously it would melt, it would go through the ice, and then you could probe deeper into the ethane and methane and grab your materials that way. Fantastic. So anything else, Vincent?
We're going to have like a little submarine thing attached to the bottom of it. So when it drills down, it's going to drop in there. Also, we're going to like have a disc that shoots into the methane lake, which will take samples.
Does it radio it back, or what happens? Does it come back?
I think we're going to make the disc so it comes back, maybe.
What about the little submarine?
Due to our relatively low budget, we're going to send it there, have it stream the data back, and then just leave it on Titan.
And there's no self-destructive button that it hits to make it disappear, huh?
No.
Unfortunately.
Too harmful.
So were you convinced in your research that this is possible, that you probably would discover life?
We're not just going to go out and just say that there's life on Titan, but we do think there are very high chances that life could be there or could live there, survive.
I also go with Leah because most of the experiments that we do here, they're towards further discovery, and so there's probably a very high chance.
Vincent, what about your take?
There's many factors that life could exist. There's many factors that could not exist. So you can't really say there's not or is life unless you make a mission there.
Well, the mission obviously has been successful in the sense that arguably NASA would approve based on what you've done. So congratulations to all of you on that. Now let's bring in one of the parents who has sat patiently in front of the microphone, and that is Vincent's father, Ken. And you've been here, you've been taking pictures and filming and hearing what these young people have had to say, and certainly I'm sure you're very proud of Vincent. Talk about the parent side of things when it comes to the program.
Wasn't a whole lot. Dropped him off, went in for the interview beforehand, missed him while he was gone, picked him up, a few emails back and forth. Got his stuff packed beforehand. I try to provide him with the guidance, but he makes pretty much all the decisions on his own. I just kind of let him fly and see where he'll, how far he'll go. I've told him a million times that just getting to work with Professor Delano, some of that would rub off on him. Meeting Mr. Harris would be a great opportunity as far as his resume goes. Just being in the RPI program. RPI is one of the schools he's talked about and looked at in his future.
Again, Vincent and Neil and Leah, I wish you the best of luck in your future endeavors.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Those were the students who participated in last summer's ExxonMobil Bernard Harris Summer Science Camp from upstate New York, speaking with the best of our knowledge's science reporter David Gustina as part of our astrobiology series on the origins of life. Our coverage is made possible by the NASA Astrobiology Institute through support from the New York Center for Astrobiology, located at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, in partnership with the University at Albany, the University of Arizona, and Syracuse University. You can learn more about all of the topics in our astrobiology series at origins.rpi.edu. Well, coming back to Earth, there is a connection between the highest winds and the deepest ocean currents. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. Other than being difficult to access, the upper atmosphere and ocean depths may seem to have little in common. But as Thomas Rieschler, associate professor of atmospheric science at the University of Utah, reveals, the two regions appear to be profoundly connected.
For decades, scientists have been trying to improve the accuracy of climate predictions. One avenue of research suggests that the stratosphere, which is the layer of the atmosphere between 6 and 30 miles above the Earth's surface, is an important component. Our recent study supports this idea. From direct observations and from computer simulations, we found that wind changes in the stratosphere influence the ocean. By striking a vulnerable Achilles heel in the North Atlantic, these changes alter mile-deep ocean circulation patterns, which in turn affect Earth's climate. Such a link is quite amazing because, compared to the dense ocean, the stratosphere has very little mass, making it hard to believe that the stratosphere could cause changes to the ocean. But our research finds that a chain of complicated natural events is responsible for making exactly this happen. This is how it works. During winter, winds in the stratosphere are usually strong and regular. However, sometimes catastrophic circulation events happen in the stratosphere, abruptly interrupting the normal flow. These events can be even felt at the surface, in particular over a region of the North Atlantic to the south of Greenland. This is the so-called downwelling region, which is a crucial source of deep water that drives the circulation of the ocean. There, small variations in temperature and thus density determine whether water is heavy enough to sink or not. Through its impact on surface winds, the stratosphere creates variations in evaporation and water temperature. Because of the sensitivity of the ocean over this region, the variations are able to accelerate or delay the sinking of water into the abyss. Through this process, the stratosphere acts like a throttle, accelerating or slowing the engine that drives worldwide ocean currents and our planet's climate.
That was Thomas Rieschler of the University of Utah. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.